It's open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go through our agenda in order today. I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2482 with Kyle.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2482 is the first of four bills that we have that come to us from the Department of Revenue. 2482, what it would do, it would clarify the assessment responsibilities of the Department of Revenue and county assessor offices relating to the valuation of industrial property. It requires the county assessor to appraise property for five consecutive years following a request by the county for assessment responsibility of what would otherwise be state-appraised industrial property. There's some clarification to the appeals process, definition of terms, and it would apply to assessment years beginning on or after January 1st, 2015, and property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015, which those are the same thing. It's just the assessment year begins on January 1, where the tax year begins on July 1. So the January 1 and July 1, 2015 are the same tax year it's covering.
All right, let's hear from the Department of Revenue, John Phillips, and Randy Walruff. And Mark Garz.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. House Bill 2482 is essentially a housekeeping bill. It has one component that might be considered sort of policy related, and I'd like to just kind of go through it now if I could. There's a transfer process that occurs between the department and the counties, and this is kind of what this bill is focused on. It's also focused on the department's participation in the appraisal of industrial property. So you've dealt with centrally assessed property this session. This is not about centrally assessed property. It's about industrial property. So the industrial property typically is defined as any manufacturing that's worth $1 million or more. And that's actually been adopted sort of in stages. Initially, back in 89, the law was changed to say that the department would appraise any manufacturing of $5 million or more. And at that time, that was referred to as principal industrial property. So that was kind of state appraised. And then for that, part of the money that's used to help finance the assessment and taxation system throughout the state was split between the assessors and the department. The department for appraising those high-value properties. The thought was there was more expertise centralized in one location, whereas you might have a rural county with a large manufacturing that they're not familiar with. It kind of gave the opportunity for some specialization in appraisal, and that's how that worked. Later on, it became the idea was that, well, maybe industrials that are valued at $1 million or more should go to the state, and then the money was switched between the two to kind of compensate for the appraisal for the state on that. So now the state, through the Department of Revenue, appraises manufacturing of $1 million or more. But over time, these were called principal, and then the second part was called secondary, and really that's kind of not important anymore. It's a distinction without a difference. They're really state-appraised accounts. So fundamentally, this bill, one thing it does is it just says eliminates those terms altogether and just says these are state-appraised accounts. There are some cases where counties want to or have the capacity to or have more expertise in a particular industrial, and they would like to appraise that themselves. And so there is a process currently in law that says the department can transfer accounts to the county if the county decides that it wants to take on that account. And some counties do that. So this bill also kind of cleans up, makes it a little more easier for the county and the state to work out who's going to appraise which account. And some archaic language that is still in there is removed, basically requiring the county to justify the fact that it has the resources to appraise the account. The other thing this does is that it cleans up some appeal language from several years ago when appeals for industrial property were changed in the direction that they went. Traditional properties, their first shot at an appeal goes to the local board of property tax appeal. That's kind of a local board of volunteers who just operate in each county. The second level of appeal is the magistrate division of the tax court. And the third level is the regular division. So several sessions ago, we said, It doesn't make sense for a large manufacturing facility to go to the Board of Property Tax Appeals, where they have basically 15 minutes to present their appeal, and the board really doesn't have expertise to deal with that. And so large industrials were sent to directly to the magistrate division. But the problem became that when counties and the department transferred accounts between the two, it got confusing for taxpayers. Well, the county's now appraising me now. Where do I appeal now? So it got confusing. There were appeals filed in the wrong venues. People lost some of their appeal rights. This would clean up that language to say, if the state's appraising it, it does follow the track to the magistrate first. If the county's appraising it, it goes to the Board of Property Tax Appeals first. So in the worst-case scenario, this change would allow some of those companies, which end up being county appraised, an extra appeal. It doesn't take away any appeal rights from any of those companies. It would give them an extra appeal in the certain cases where the county is actually taking over that appraisal. So I think that's pretty much the substance of the bill. And like I said, it's mostly cleanup. It does streamline that appeal process, and it would make it a lot more clear for taxpayers and counties to know where that first appeal is. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. You guys care to add on to that? Or you?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Randy Wolf, Multnomah County Assessor and President of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. And I'm here today to answer any technical questions and to note our support as an association for this bill, all four bills, in fact, and the fact that this bill is the result of a collaborative effort between the Assessors Association and the Department of Revenue to clean this up. And it's an important bill to us, and we're very happy with this outcome of 2 years of work on this.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. I guess for everybody, why $1 million? $1 million when we started this is a whole lot different than it is today. And when we get out in another, if we listen to everybody telling us how fast real estate's going off, $1 million, you guys will be assessing pole barns in the middle of nowhere shortly. Mm-hmm. So why did we pick $1 million?
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, that actually the choice of $1 million was before my time, and I don't recall the reason for that. And I know just about every year since then we've talked about that $1 million as to, you know, does this make sense anymore? Should we change this? Should we index it? There's been a lot of discussion. One of the things that's been sort of a drag on any suggestion for change is that there is this transfer process. So if a county has a property that's over $1 million that it feels it has the capacity and the experience and the knowledge to appraise, they can take it. And if it's under $1 million and they want the department to take it, we can also transfer that to the department too. So, but I can certainly, I think that's the reason, but Randy might have a more.
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, I would add that it wouldn't be a pole barn, but this bill was designed to fit all 36 counties, and it primarily industrial property involves manufacturing processes, so that for in small counties, they could have a facility that's just over $1 million and they do not have the staff and the expertise and the ability to recruit industrial appraisers to do those types of projects. In Multnomah County, we've actually taken back quite a number of our properties because we are able to attract appraisers with those industrial skill sets. So again, $1 million, you wouldn't see one in Multnomah County. We're trying to take back and appraise directly in our county everything under $20 to $40 million. I hope that answers that.
Follow up. In terms of once you transfer it over, get a new appraiser expense, is there a way, what is, walk through the process of taking it back? Oh, and I'm looking at the county, not the state. Let's say you gave it to the state, and now you have the expertise or the building that you gave to them now due to valuation. I mean, simple flat inflation is now in the category in which you can do it yourselves. How do you take it back from the state?
Each year we contact the Department of Revenue, the industrial section, and we have a list of accounts that we are interested in either transferring back and forth, and we actually collaborate with them, have a discussion on. My staff meets with their staff, and then we come to a conclusion. And in the end, the Department of Revenue is the decision maker here. So I think to answer your question, the counties are still always responsible for the land on these accounts. So it's a continue back and forth discussion of the value of the account and how is the best method to appraise it. For us in this bill, having that five-year commitment, basically, unless the use of the property changes significantly, this has not been an issue. When you ask that question, I try to recollect when we've had a controversy with the Department of Revenue on this discussion, and I cannot think of one. It's pretty much straight.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I've had multiple constituents come to me. Of course, I have five counties, so that leaves a broad deal. And, you know, they've gone to the assessor and says, you know, why are we doing it this way? And the answer has always been, don't talk to us. It's not our fault. It's an industrial property. Blame the Department of Revenue. Go talk to them. So the assessor, you know, who wants to be elected, then tries to skate out from underneath his responsibility. So I know there's problems out there. I mean, the question there is, you know, obviously if I have assessors who are on the opposite side of the fence that you just presented, I'm not sure the conclusion of how many people are for or against this thing.
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, I can only answer that indirectly as president of the association. The association did vote to support this. I do not know of assessors that were opposed to all this. In fact, cleaning up the language that the department is definitely responsible for the $1 million and over. We've had an ongoing discussion for years. What was the difference between $1 million and $5 million? And as John testified, that was before my time too, and I've been doing this for 30 years. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question directly, but the state is responsible for the appraisals. The state is responsible for the appeal process, and John talked about that the first step in the appeal process bypasses the local board and goes straight to the magistrate court. So I can see the scenario in which an assessor in a small county who simply receives the value transmittal sheet from the Department of Revenue, and the department is responsible for the appraisal, passing the questions back to the department. I could definitely see that.
Interesting.
Okay, just out of curiosity, when you contract with appraisers to do this work in Multnomah County, I was just wondering what the industrial appraisals.
Senator Haas, they are employees. I have a staff of six industrial appraisers at Multnomah County, and we find it more efficient for Multnomah County to appraise those accounts in our county directly.
Great, that's what I wanted to know. Any other questions on this bill? I'm going to close a public hearing and go into a work session on House Bill 2482. Senator Boquist.
I'll be happy to move it, but I think it'll be a no vote. I'll move House Bill 2482 to the floor with a do pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2482 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. We have no amendments. Senator Boquist, do you want to discuss
This jumped up at me, and I've had a whole bunch of constituents who've raised issues similar to this, and I'm just not comfortable voting yes for it at the moment. And I'm looking at the broad relating clause, and to be blunt, there may be other things that we have that we're doing in the committee that we don't have a relating clause that might need that relating clause for. I'm a no vote. I'm not necessarily opposed to the bill. I just haven't. I unfortunately have not done my homework and not delved into this enough at the moment.
Okay. Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bertschinger?
Yes.
Senator Edwards?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Haas?
Haas votes aye. House Bill 2482 passes, goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do-pass recommendation. When we're over to Senator Riley, would you be so kind to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2483. Kyle?
Okay, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2483 is a second bill we have from the Department of Revenue. It would clarify appeals rights of any party to appeal entire unit of property as defined in ORS 310-160 sub 1. And what that statute relates to is it consists of all contiguous property under common ownership within a single code area. So there was amendment language in the House that did narrow a bit the scope of the bill. I would mention we do have the paperwork is in there, no fiscal, and it's a minimal revenue impact.
Okay. John, can you set us up with the problem and the solution?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. The theme here is, again, industrial property, and the situation is where properties are appraised. Often the manufacturing facilities that are appraised have multiple accounts. Sometimes that's for the convenience of the taxpayer. Sometimes it has to do with when different phases were purchased. But when these manufacturing facilities are appraised, they're appraised as a single unit. So it's an operating unit, like a line over here for processing wood or food is connected to the next line that's connected to shipping. And it's all an operating unit, and that's the way it's appraised and valued. But yet, the assessor, in the end, has to, for the tax statements, assign values to each of those accounts. And I'm not going to say it's arbitrary, but it's not as precise as the importance of getting the value of the operating unit correct. Over time, it was observed that it's better to have the opportunities in an appeal to look at the whole unit because that's the way it's actually valued. So back some time ago, I think it was 2011, the law was changed to say that if a party, either the taxpayer or the department or the county, is appealing a component of the unit, the other party can ask for the other components to be reviewed so that the court can look at, or the entity that's reviewing the appeal can look at the whole account and see what the unit value is. And that way we get at the correct market value. But in 2012, there was a bill that broke out machinery and equipment. So you would look at these manufacturing facilities and all the machinery and equipment might have its own account. And the way that the language is for this component appeal law is that it says that if any account is appealed. And we think it'd be better to change the law to say that if any unit is appealed. So if you look at the bill itself, the only really thing that's changing here is, it's a very short bill, the only thing that's really changing here is a reference to what constitutes a unit of property, and that is if any party appeals what constitutes a unit of property, the other party can appeal any other component of that unit, so that whatever's before the court is the whole picture. We want to look at the whole picture. And so this just aligns your policy back to 2011 when you made the decision to say, look, the court needs to look at the whole picture and determine the correct market value. And that is the substance of that bill. It passed the House, if I might add, 58 yes and 2 excused.
Let's call in those 2 excused. Any questions, Senator Bertschinger?
So if I'm understanding, I have a manufacturing facility. One of the pieces of equipment, I think, has been overtaxed, overvalued. And so I take it to the court. When I do that, then I put all the other pieces of equipment on the block to be re-looked at. So what I could be doing is I might have a tax decrease on the, but I might have a tax increase on the other pieces. Is that correct?
Or decrease.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Bertschinger, if you feel that the total value is incorrect, then that taxpayer should appeal that piece of machinery and equipment. Now, maybe that's the point where the assessor or the department would say, well, that piece is overvalued, because a lot of what happens after an appeal is discussion, conversation. And, you know, the taxpayer knows their property a whole lot better because they purchased it, they've operated it, they have people there. Our people are maybe once a year at the very most going to even be in that building. So, first of all, there's going to be a conversation. Then there'll be a discussion about whether it's overvalued or if it's correctly valued. We might look at other parts of the account that say, well, it's overvalued. We don't see anything else here that's undervalued. So it might make sense to change that, and that does happen. It's more of a situation where a building and a whole operation, or someone's appealing just the land of the whole operation and not the buildings, and you're sorting between those components.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, no other questions. We're in work session, Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair,
this is 2483, right?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2483 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2483 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Senator Bershiger seemed to be very attuned to this and know what it was talking about.
Yes.
Seems like a good carrier to me.
Impressive. Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2483 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. And Senator Bershiger, you are the resident expert on this bill.
Really?
And your name is up next.
Close enough. All right. We'll see how that goes.
All right. Senator Bershiger will be the carrier. I'll open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2484. Kyle is here, and the revenue team is still here. I think we're developing a theme here today.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Bill number 3 from Department of Revenue, House Bill 2484, would extend deadlines and eliminates extension for filing certain property tax returns with Department of Revenue. It applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2016. And we do have the fiscal and revenue impact. There's no fiscal and no revenue impact.
John Phillips. Mark Garst.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Before you today is House Bill 2484, which deals with property tax return extensions. This bill passed the House Revenue Committee unanimously and passed the House floor on the consent calendar. I imagine you're all familiar with income tax returns. It's how we tell the federal government or state how much money we made and how much tax we owe. You may be a little bit less familiar with property tax returns. Businesses in Oregon file a return to show the state or county what property they have, when they bought it, what they paid for it, and those types of things. This bill addresses an issue with how those returns are filed. Taxpayers currently file by March 1st, but can request an extension to April 15th. The extension requests go to the Department of Revenue in the case of state appraised accounts, or they will go to the county for county appraised accounts. In the case of a taxpayer who has property in multiple counties, you might think about a fast food chain, they would be allowed to file to the state for the extensions in the multiple counties. The department and the counties recognized in 2007 that there were some issues with our extension process, and the law was passed at that time. It did two things. First, it relaxed the standards for extensions. We realized that we weren't really evaluating each extension request on its merits. We just didn't really have the staff to do that, and we thought that if we just gave folks more time, that it would equal better returns, and that's not actually what we've seen. The second thing that the 2007 law did was it allowed this ability for taxpayers who had property in multiple counties to file a single extension request with the state. We thought that this would make things easier on the taxpayer, and frankly, that's not been the case either. What we found is that there's been some confusion on the part of taxpayers about where they are to file that extension, and we've had some folks miss their extensions as a result. Our solution, supported by the governor, would be to extend the filing date for 2 weeks. That would be to March 15th for all taxpayers and eliminate the six-week extension process. What we're trying to do here is strike a balance between administrative workload and adequate time to file, and also to eliminate the current confusion that exists about where to file the extensions. Just a little background. Last year, 2014, we processed just under 3,000 extensions for these multi-county type extensions and 525 extensions on our industrial properties, which is 35% of our total returns. We don't really know. We don't track how many extensions happened at the county level, but we do know that it's a significant number of extensions. As I mentioned before, the goal in 2007 by relaxing the standards was to get better returns. What the department does right now is as the returns come in, we look at them and we try and identify whether they are substantially complete, whether they have enough information for us to go ahead and process the return. Through this triage process, we found that on the taxpayers who file timely, that is by March 1st, 12% of the returns are insufficient. On taxpayers who take an extension, however, it jumps up to 17% of the returns are actually not sufficiently complete. When we don't have a complete return, we send it back to the taxpayer. It takes a couple weeks generally to kind of get the return in order so that we can process it. And so what we have is a process where someone's just taken 6-week extension, Now we're still trying to struggle to get the information out of them that we need to process the return, and it can easily be a couple months before we're able to actually get down to our business. By administrative rule, the department transfers values to the county to the best of our ability on state appraised accounts by July 1st. So this is really putting us into a situation where we have a very limited amount of time to actually process these returns. And it's important that we get that information to the counties as soon as possible because they have to set their role. Due to the number of extensions that we're currently processing, we really don't have the staff to go through these and identify, you know, what type of need exists. So, you know, good and sufficient cause, we might kind of ask the people, well, you were sick, but how sick were you? You know, somebody was out of state, were they on vacation, or did they have to go to a funeral? And we just don't have the time to go through those kind of questions. So the way it is now, we just kind of, any extension will go through, any extension request. Counties vary on how they process these extensions. Some of them are pretty strict on who they'll give them to and kind of read to the letter of the law. Some of them are pretty relaxed on who they'll give extensions to. So we have a situation where taxpayers in different counties are getting different ability to extend, and we don't think it really meets the legislative intent. If someone, even if this bill passes, if someone does have can show good and sufficient cause, they can go to their Board of Property Tax Appeals and request that the penalty be waived, and the board has the ability to grant that even with this bill. And then in the case of a first-time filer who maybe really hasn't gotten it together yet, the assessor also can waive the penalty for late filing, so the taxpayer won't be without some recourse. Surrounding state, 9 of the western contiguous states do not have extensions. The other states have varied extensions. Anecdotally, we've heard that taxpayers will sometimes, if they have property in multiple states, they'll file an extension in Oregon and then do the returns in the states that don't have extensions. And so we kind of feel like we've put ourselves on the back burner a little bit. In the process of getting this bill together, we've contacted stakeholders, Associated Oregon Industries, Oregon Business Association, National Federation of Independent Businesses, and we haven't seen any significant concerns. We've reached out to individual taxpayers. We got feedback. Most of it was positive, but we had a minimal response overall. We also spoke with one gentleman who lost his extension ability because of filing to the wrong venue, and kind of ran this by him, and he said that this would have definitely solved his problem. And what he said he's going to do from now on is just file an extension request to both the state and the county, because he still doesn't understand, you know, where he's supposed to file that. So the language is pretty straightforward. Section 1 amends 308-290 to change the filing deadline to all taxpayers from March 1st to March 15th. It eliminates any statutory references to the extension process. And then Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 basically conform to these other statutes. This would be effective starting with 2016 returns. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Bircher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is dealing with personal property tax, correct?
Chair Haas, Senator Bear Sugar, yes, and also some real property. So our industrial taxpayers who have state responsible file a combined return to the state that has both real and personal property. Taxpayers at the county level generally are filing just a personal property return, but some county-identified industrial accounts also will file what's called a real property return, and this bill would deal with all three of those types of returns.
But a personal follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
A personal property tax return is not mandatory, isn't that voluntary?
I think Randy would be able to speak better to that. Do you want to take that one?
Sure. Chair Haas, Senator Bearshorter, it is mandatory to file a personal property business tax return in this state. There is a cancellation of assessment for property valued under $16,000.
Further questions? Well, we're in a work session.
Chair, I move House Bill 2484 to the floor with a do pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2484 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Discussion?
I guess it's my turn, Mr. Chair. It's my turn. It's your turn. Do you want to come in?
One like this.
Oh, is it?
Objections. Seeing none, House Bill 2484 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. I'm happy to carry because it's my turn, but if you have a preference, it's Senator Boquist will take this bill. Oh. Senator Boquist will be the carrier. Moving on to our continuing our theme today, I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2487.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2487 is the fourth and final of the DR bills we have up today. It would require correction of maximum assessed value resulting from assessor changes in property square footage to be proportional to change in real market value of property resulting from the changes in the property square footage. So when there's a change being made, it'd be equal to the actual value of the property change. Under a existing law, there is the change can happen under existing law right now, except the change has to be in proportion to the change in the square footage, which may or may not line up with the actual change in the value. So this would change the current law. We do have the paperwork on this one. There's no fiscal, and the revenue impact is expected to be minimal.
Thank you. Panel? John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I think Kyle's pretty much said it. What this bill does is it tries to change the formula that's used to make these corrections. And so just focusing on the formula. What the correction is about, though, is that if there's an error on your account, whether it's residential, commercial, or whatever, in square footage, and you for whatever reason someone measured it wrong, or it was your plan said it was going to be this and the assessor put it on, but actually you didn't bill to that, let's say it's an error in square footage, that's smaller, that reduces the square footage, you can petition the assessor to ask for an adjustment in your maximum assessed value. And as you know, when Measure 50 came in, maximum assessed value was set, and it was set to grow by 3%, but it was not set to decrease. So this bill that created this square footage correction error was one of the very first bills years ago, I can't remember when it was, but 2007, I think, that said maximum assessed value can decrease. It was the first bill, I believe, that allowed for a decrease, and that is if the assessor had the wrong square footage on the roll. So this allowed the assessor for the very first time to decrease maximum assessed value, which in most cases decreases the actual taxable value. So this was a great thing. It allowed that to happen. But the formula that it used was that it would say whatever square footage, you basically divide the market value by that square footage and remove the market value associated with that percentage. That's fine in some cases, but in many cases it's not fine. And that is because, as you may know, not all square footage has equal value. Square footage in your attic may not have equal value to actual living space, for example, or storage area may not be as valuable as production area. So what this bill does is it says, to the extent that the value is reduced, I'll actually go to the bill itself. It puts the change to be proportional to the change in market value for the current tax year. That's due to the correction. So all this bill does is it just says if you change the market value and reduce it, that's the relative difference in the maximum assessed value. It's just the same percentage.
What if you increase it? What if you increase it? I mean, I'm thinking of the guy who adds the attic living space. Does it work in reverse? I mean, does an assessor come in and say, well, it's attic space, so it's not worth as much as living room space?
Mr. Chair, I can think of several scenarios where square footage, if it's just an error where there's more square footage than you expected, then the taxpayer probably wouldn't bring that to the attention of the assessor. And this is all driven by a petition from the taxpayer.
Oh, this is just the
case. Now, if a person added square footage, just had new construction, new improvements, that would be what's called an exception event to Measure 50, and the assessor would come out. There'd probably be a permit, hopefully. And that has a whole process.
Hopefully.
So this is just about reducing. So basically the bottom line to this is that this is a tool. This is a tool for taxpayers to use to affect the taxable value of their property to reduce it. It's not being used to the extent it could be because of the formula. If we change the formula, then assessors will be free to make changes where they're now not really able to do that. So, and I mean able, I mean they feel that the formula that's in existing law doesn't correctly reflect the value in some cases. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Senator Boquist?
No. You ready to move?
Any other questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2487 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2487 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Objection? Seeing none. House Bill 2487 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. I will be the carrier. Those are the four bills we have from the department. We have one other bill. First of all, before we get to that, Senator Edwards, did you want to vote on the bill that
I would like to.
I think it was 2483 and 2484.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules, allow Senator Edwards to vote on said bills.
Without objection, Senator Edwards wants to vote on House Bill 2483.
Yes.
Edwards votes yes. And on 2484?
Yes.
We need to do a separate. Okay. Okay. I think you're covered.
Thank you.
We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2493. We don't have the paperwork in here to move it yet, but Senator Bertschiger, you requested an amendment, the dash threes, for this measure. Did you want to speak to that?
Why don't we let Mazen give us kind of an overview, and then I'll
okay.
speak to it.
Mr. Chair, the amendment that you have in all of us basically adjusts the language that we had in the bottom of the bill in 2493A that talks about the long-term forecast for the Debt Advisory Commission and make that a more specific type of language rather than talking about the long term in its descriptive way, have it to be defined in a way that is consistent with the other citation in statutes, primarily ORS 291, where that appears twice on the 6-year description of the long-term forecast for both the budget and for the issues of debt and bonding. So this amendment basically says that the forecast for that report will be at least for 6 years, which opens the door for it to be for longer, but at least for 6 years, which makes it specific. And also connects it to be consistent with the most recently published revenue forecast for the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. This is the state economist forecast, where they do it at a 10-year out of 10-year forecast out of primarily best practices type of thing rather than a statutory requirement. So if it's 6 years specified here, and if the Debt Advisory Commission wants to go with the 10 years, that is permissive language in that sense.
Senator Bertschiger?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's just in the original bill, it just said long-term forecast, and what this amendment does is just really give us a better definition of what a long-term forecast, or what the state perceives as a long-term forecast.
In the language change?
Change it to 6 years.
To at least
6 years.
At least 6 years.
Yeah, at least 6 years.
Yeah, okay. All right, any questions on that, Senator Boquist?
Just for the argument, Mr. Chair, if you recall during testimony, it was actually testified that the plan was to try and align this, or if we'd made changes to align it to our normal revenue forecast, and really that's all the amendment does. It aligns it so the two are aligned and it's now clearer. The intent was that it was to align them and make them work together, and this does that.
Okay, good. I'm going to close the work session on 2493, and we will carry it over until tomorrow.
Do we need? We don't need to put the amendment in to do the fiscal, do we?
We can add it when we.
Yeah, we can do it.
Let's do it tomorrow.
We need the paperwork on it.
Right, right. That's what I mean, though. Because some amendments are so complex, you have to have the amendment in it before you can do the fiscal. Okay.
That clears out our agenda. Thank you. We are adjourned. Thank you. We are adjourned.